You're listening to IRIS, the local radio reading information service for the blind and the print handicapped. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 4th. I'm Sean from Drake University. Here's our first story. So for local news on November 4th, we have Face the Day, Nicholas Minner. Nicholas Minner helped make history for the Heartland Christian School last month. Milner, 14, is a native of Council Bluffs. He's the son of Scott and Sadie Milner, and he has three siblings, Ryan, Katie, and Zachary. Milner just started his high school career, and he's a freshman at Heartland Christian School. He said his time at Heartland Christian has been positive, and he's ready for many more great experiences. "It has been great so far," he said. "I have made friends, and it's just been a really great experience." Milner is a student athlete, competing in swimming, track, and cross country. Only a freshman, he already felt the glory of punching a ticket into a state competition. This is just the second year of Heartland Christian's cross country program, and Milner and a fellow freshman, Grace Steinmetz, are the first two students from the school to make it to state. Milner placed 62nd with a time of 18:02.97 in the Class A1 championship race. He said it was an unforgettable experience, and he'll be training to make it back next year with a better time. It was really nice to be able to go to state as a freshman, he said. "It was a little overwhelming at first, but once the adrenaline started pumping, I was able to enjoy the experience." With cross country behind him for the year, Milner said he was ready to keep training for the upcoming winter and spring sports sessions. He said he was excited to play the sports for the next 3 years, and he'll be enlisting in the U.S. Marine Corps after high school. Outside of school and athletes, Milner said he enjoys mountain biking and spending time with friends and family. Courtney Justin Steinmetz. The next story is Review of Dune. It's a stunning science fiction epic. I had never heard of Dune or any other works of fiction written by Frank Herbert until recently. I tried to read the first book in Dune series when I had learned it was going to be a movie coming out based on it. The opening pages bombarded me with words that were so foreign and complicated it made me stop thinking and question my grasp on the English language. The latest adaptation of Dune, directed by Denis Villeneuve, is so good that it has inspired me to give the book a second chance. Now let me get this out of the way. This movie is actually part one and covers roughly a third of the first book. Some might be annoyed that the film does not tell the entire story in one sitting, but I'm glad that the filmmakers are taking the time to give the entire novel a fleshed-out adaptation. I have not seen David Lynch's 1984 version of Dune. One complaint that I have heard about the movie is that it's a speedrun of the first novel. Essentially, it glosses over the intricate details in favor of cramming in the entire story. This new adaptation of Dune takes its times, sometimes at a snail's pace, to introduce the audience to the world and its characters. Dune is about Paul, the son of a noble family entrusted with the protection of the most valuable asset and most vital element in the galaxy. Now, I think it is funny that there are all these complicated names with the universe, and the main character is named something ordinary like Paul. I tried to think of the best way to summarize the film without spoiling the best way to describe. The best way to describe the movie to say it was like a space version of Game of Thrones. There's political warfare, assassinations, betrayal, intense action sequences, mystical visions, spice melange, and instead of dragons, there are these giant sandworms. The movie is a slow build, and I was left wondering when things were going to pick up. I can assure the community that the slow build is worth it for the most part when the film picks up. I was at the edge of my seat. I think Timothy Charmelot does a fine job of portraying Paul, and there was a genuine moment that made me tear up with his character. Characters are the main focus of the movie, and it's so refreshing to see a film take the time to develop all of its characters. Out of all the characters in this movie, my favorite by far has to be Rebecca Ferguson's portrayal of Lady Jessica Atreides. Lady Jessica comes from a group called the Bene Gesserit. The group is an exclusive sisterhood whose members train their bodies and minds through years of physical and mental conditioning to obtain superhuman powers. Lady Jessica has some of the most epic action sequences, and there is the emotional turmoil to boot that really cements her as a standout character. Aside from the immersive character development, the scenery was some of the best I have ever seen in the silver screen. There are multiple times when there was a screen that made my jaw drop in awe. Sometimes the movie takes too long to focus on certain set pieces and the movie slows more down than I want it to. A complaint for me is that Zendaya, who plays Chani in the movie, is marketed as the big role in the movie, but in reality, she has less than 10 minutes of screen time. I felt bamboozled, but hopefully her role is expanded in the second movie, which as of October 26th has been confirmed. Overall, Dune is impeccable on every level: cinematography, sound design, and characterization. If there is any movie that the world needs to see in 2021, Dune is that movie. I review movies on a scale of 1 bucket of popcorn to 5 buckets of popcorn. 1 bucket of popcorn would be the worst film of the year, and 5 buckets of popcorn is a masterpiece, or in the very least, a film that will make the rounds at the award shows. Dune earns 4.5 buckets of popcorn for being near masterpiece that at times get bogged down by necessary world building. Dune is poised, like its source material, to endure as one of the best science fiction movies of all time. The next story, review The Chestnut Man, a satisfying Scandinavian detective series. Some of my favorite dark and brooding detective films / TV series are Scandinavian. The Department of Q Quadrology, Keeper of Lost Causes, 2013, The Absent One, 2014, A Conspiracy of Faith, 2016, and Journal 64, 2018, which has yet to be released in the US, is a must-watch. It's the pinnacle of greatness. I enjoyed the BBC Kenneth Branagh-helmed remake of The Wallander, 2008-16. Loved Venda Studd's remake of The Killing, 2011-14. And of course, I love the Danish original, not the remake, of The Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, 2009. Although it's not the same league as these, The Chestnut Man, now showing on Netflix, is still pretty good and worth a watch. Based on the novel by Sora Sivistup, who created the Danish version of The Killing, The Chestnut Man follows Det Thurland, Daniel Kirk, and her new partner, Hess, Michael Bo Furgard, and they try to figure out who is murdering women and leaving behind small dolls composed of chestnuts. The initial victim is missing a hand and an eye, and the subsequent victims become missing an eye and more appendages. Two hands and a foot? Who could be doing this? Why are they doing this? What's the connection to the chestnut men? And how are the crimes tied to the disappearance of the daughter of the Danish politician, Rosa Hotberg, played by Ruben Donner? Thelum is a dedicated investigator, so much so that her relationship with her daughter, Leva Rhys Fulden, is strained, and she also initially has friction with Hess, whose heart doesn't seem to be in his work. She writes him off as a slacker. As the six-part series progresses, Thelum and Hess learn to lean on each other, and their bond grows, so that, by the end, you are hoping there will be more investigations in the future. I was a bit sad to see it end. The actors are all very good. Kruk was in Denmark Q, The Absent One, as a woman who, because of her past, is now living on the streets in fear. She was like a wounded, feral animal in that. Here, she's your typical cop, who is great at her job, but really awful at dealing with human beings. She has a lot of baggage and isn't very warm. Fulsgaard, interestingly, was also in the Department of Q film, but this time in The Absent One, as the traumatized / disabled brother of a woman who gets kidnapped and held in a pressure chamber. Before that, and the first time I saw him, he was a historical drama, A Royal Affair, 2012, which is a phenomenal film in which he plays Christian VII, the Mad King of Denmark. He is very versatile and reminded me of Frederick Weller, who played Marshall Mann in the 2008-2012 TV series In Plain Sight. In The Chestnut Man, his character was a traumatic past. His wife and infant died in a fire, and he is on leave from Interpol. He's distracted by wanting to get back to his job and can't wait to move on. As the series continues, he becomes an intellectual part, or an integral part of the investigation. If you liked The Killing, film's kind of hot mess, Neglectful Parent, although not as much as Sarah Lindell, by Mira Enos, she's more of a stoic and not as charismatic as Stefan Holder, by Joel Kinnaman. But the relationship is similar. Initially, she wants him to stay out of her way, then they become close, relying on each other. Although they are only playing supporting characters, Espen Dahlgren Andersen is very believable as the distraught, drowning in his sorrow and alcohol, father of the kidnapped girl, David Denark, who is also in Department Q, the absent one, is notable as the head of forensics, and Donner is good as a mother who is trying to craft normalcy by returning to the political spotlight. Story-wise, The Chestnut Man has its ups and downs. The initial murder on the farm, it's a flashback. It's pretty unsettling. It drew me in and hooked me, and towards the end of the series, things really got tense and unnerving. I think I was shouting at the screen, although I didn't much like the main characters initially. They seemed bland. I eventually grew to care about them. The political backdrop muddied in the story a bit, and there was some time dedicated to a guy who confessed to kidnapping and killing the daughter. But then there's questions about that, and there's a lot of back and forth in time, which means you really gotta pay attention. Sometimes the series is doing too much when it should just be straightforward. Just solve the damn case. A few times, I thought I might need to rewind and rewatch parts so I could keep up. I don't know if this was a problem with translation or if it was more of a cultural thing. I admit, I don't know a lot about Danish politics, and we don't exactly have the same traditions of crafting chestnut men and singing songs about them. So there is a slight learning curve here. And finally, when the killer was revealed, I wasn't sure how I felt about it. Looking back, it felt a bit manufactured. I certainly didn't guess who it was, so it was a surprise if that means anything. The end hinted at more to come, and I would certainly watch this duo tackling about another murdering investigation. Of course, they would have to do some jockeying to get them back onto a homicidal investigation. But hey, if The Killing can do it, so can this show. And if anybody can do it, it's Netflix. Which, after The Killing, was canceled after 3 seasons. They brought it back for a fourth to give audiences some closure. Was it perfect? No. Was I glad to see those two working on another investigation? You bet. In fact, I wish Enos and Kinnaman would do anything again as these characters. A standalone film? Sure. The Chestnut Man has times when it lags, and I did question midway and care enough to watch another 3 episodes, but I'm glad I finished it. Overall, it was a satisfying addition to the serial killer / Scandinavian detective corpus. Alright, next story is the forecast. High in the mid-50s, dry today. The weather today is 45 with the wind up to 17 miles per hour, according to the National Weather Service. Temps will be in the 30s and the 40s in the morning before climbing to the high around 3 p.m. The low is 39, with the wind speeds as high as 20 miles per hour. Here's the upcoming forecast according to the weather services. Today, mostly sunny with a high of near 45. South wind 5 to 11 p.m. with gusts as high as 17 miles per hour. Tonight's increasing clouds with a low around 39. South-southwest wind 7 to 10 miles per hour with gusts as high as 20 miles per hour. Friday, mostly sunny with a high near 59. South winds 11 to 17 miles per hour with gusts as high as 28 miles per hour. Friday night, mostly clear with a low around 42. South winds 5 to 9 miles per hour, becoming light west-southwest after midnight. Saturday, sunny with a high near 65. Saturday night, mostly clear with a low around 46. Sunday, mostly sunny with a high near 66. Sunday night, mostly clear with a low around 45. Monday, mostly sunny with a high near 61. Monday night, partly cloudy with a low around 44. Tuesday, partly sunny with a high near 57. Tuesday night, mostly cloudy with a low around 47. Wednesday, a chance of rain, mostly cloudy with a high near 58. The next story is Spirit of Courage awarded to recipients to demonstrate the will to fight cancer. Cancer has touched each of the four recipients of the 2021 Spirit of Courage Awards in unique ways. Yet, each one shares the strengths and determination necessary to become a survivor. The Spirit of Courage Gala, to be held as a virtual event Saturday evening, will pay tribute to Donna Elif, Deb Potter, Jake Powers, and Kevin Rutland as representatives of all cancer patients, cancer survivors, and their families. The annual gala, along with an online auction and golf tournament, held in October, raises funds for the Spirit of Courage Cancer Center Charitable Patient Care Fund. Now in its 19th year, the Spirit of Courage events have raised nearly $2 million, with 100% of the money going to the Charitable Patient Cure Fund. This fund provides assistance to uninsured and underinsured patients who need help covering expenses associated with diagnosis and treatment of cancer. By paying for medications, treatment, and deductibles, as well as everyday living expenses such as groceries, rent, and gas, anybody who purchases a ticket to the sold-out gala will be able to view the evening speeches and testimonials online via Zoom, said Tara Sullivan, Chief Philanthropy Officer for Methodist Jenny Ellen's Hospital. Concern for the continuing spread of COVID-19 has for the second year prompted us to hold the gala as a virtual event, Sullivan said. Although the Spirit of Courage Gala is virtual, the need it addresses is very real. The diagnosis of cancer has continued throughout the pandemic, and the Methodist Jenny Elmedenson Cancer Center and its partners have worked diligently to provide exceptional care to its patients throughout Southwest Iowa. Dave Weber will be serving as Master of Ceremonies, and Methodist Jenny Edmondson Hospital President and CEO Dave Bird will also speak. Christian Markle, nurse practitioner from Heartland Oncology and Hematology, a longtime partner of the Jenny Edmondson Cancer Center, will deliver a message on behalf of the cancer treatment, on the cancer center and introduce the recipient videos. The program is expected to last about 45 minutes. Anyone who is unable to purchase a ticket but is interested in donating to the Charitable Patient Care Fund may visit the Jenny Edmondson Hospital Foundation's website at jehfoundation.org and click on the Spirit of Courage. There are so many sponsors, volunteers, and other individuals who have continued to support the Spirit of Courage event. We have had to delay and now performance and presentation, Sullivan said. The foundation sends a huge thank you to the Mid-America Center for its help shifting the event to virtual and for including delivery of the banquet meals for many patrons who have scheduled watch parties. Sullivan said the gala not only raises money for the Charitable Patient Care Fund, it also serves to recognize the efforts of the doctors, nurses, radiologists, and other caregivers, as well as all cancer patients. She said the paths of the four 2021 Spirit of Courage recipients have been difficult at times, and for some, side effects of the chemotherapy treatments and radiation therapy still persist. Donna, Deb, Jake, and Kevin have amazing experiences to share in their taped messages, Sullivan said. Their survival is a testament to their strong will. The expert care they received at the Methodist Jenny Edmondson Hospital Cancer Center and the support of Jenny Edmondson Foundation. John or Elif. Elif battled breast cancer in late 2019 and 2020 after mammogram revealed a stage 1 lump in her breast. Her last mammogram was 4 years earlier. She said, "I have no symptoms before this mammogram, so finding out I had cancer was a shock." Elif said she is fortunate her cancer was caught at early stage. She underwent a partial mastectomy, 20 radiation treatments, and 2 blood transfusions at Jenny Edmondson and 18 chemotherapy treatments at Heartland Oncology and Hematology. Her subsequent scans have been clear. She urges other women, especially those who put off routine testing during the pandemic, to get back to the scheduled tests, including mammograms. "Several women I know have told me they got their mammogram because of me," she said. "If my story can be an inspiration to others, that is awesome." Deb Potter. Potter thought she was enduring an unusually persistent winter cough when an x-ray revealed a spot in her lung. She was referred to the Summit Mukherjee, MD, a critical care pulmonologist at Jenny Edmondson Hospital, for an accurate diagnosis. Mukherjee ordered a magnetic resonance imaging scan. It revealed adenocarcinoma in two places at the top lobe of Ponder's right lung. She had a biopsy on September 11, 2018, and a lobectomy surgery was performed on October 25th by John Batter, MD, a cardiothoracic surgery, lung and thoracic oncology specialist at the Methodist Etzebrook Cancer Center. He removed the top part of my right lung, and that was it, she said. It was just gone. No chemotherapy, no radiation. Every day, I think about how blessed I am. Jaran, Jake Powers. In April 2020, just when the pandemic was capturing the minds and the fears of most Americans, Powers felt a lump in her left breast. Powers, the former volunteer coordinator at Jenny Edmondson Hospital, was working as a receptionist at Recent Sun Methodist Physicians Clinic in Council Bluffs. Provided by a worker to make an appointment, a follow-up biopsy revealed that Powers had breast cancer. The breast cancer had metastasized to the liver, which would require liver ablation prior to chemotherapy, she said. And they told me I had thyroid cancer. After her doctors determined that breast cancer was the priority, Powers began chemotherapy at Heartland Oncology and Hematology, followed by the surgery at Jenny Edmondson. They told me afterwards that the left side of the thyroid was more involved and that the cancer had taken over a vocal nerve, she said. She began radiation therapy at Jenny Edmondson, completing a series of 33 treatments on January 12, 2021. During the follow-up examination, one of her surgeons, Andrew Cullinan, MD, discovered that the repurposed nerve was moving the vocal cord on its own. On an avid singer, that news was music to her ears. She recently began vocal theory, adjusting her breathing to emanate more from her diaphragm, just as she does when she sings. Kevin Rutland. 7 years ago, after experiencing a urinary tract infection, Rutland has a prostate-specific antigen blood test, used to check the amount of PSA, a protein produced by both cancerous and non-sick cancerous tissue, in the prostate. The test is a screen for prostate cancer. They told me at the time, if the PSA level was above 10, it was quite high and should be discussed with a doctor right away, Rutland recalls. Near the end of 2019, Rutland experienced another UTI, again followed by a PSA test. The level was 38. He wasted no time in making an appointment with his urologist, who immediately scheduled a series of scans and prostate biopsy. On January 6, 2020, the results confirmed prostate cancer. Rutland began a course of hormone treatments to slow the cancer. His prostate was removed on a robotic-assisted surgery. His first PSA after the operation showed a level of 0.01, but subsequent tests over the next 9 months again showed gradual increases. It became obvious some cancer cells had evaded the removal operation, he said. Rutland underwent 35 radiation treatments in the Methodist Jenny Edmondson, ending on St. Patrick's Day, 2021. His most recent PSA test in June this year was less than 0.01. His message is positive. I will try to live every day with enthusiasm and cheerfulness, he said. Don't put off actually living every day. Those who tune in to the online Spirit of Courage event will hear more of the award recipients' compelling stories as they speak on behalf of the Foundation's continuing efforts. The Foundation couldn't help so many people without so many people helping us, Selvin said. The Charitable Patient Care Fund makes a profound difference in the lives of countless cancer patients and their families. And every dollar stays right here in Southwest Iowa. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 4th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Sean from Drake University, IRIS volunteer, love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call the toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. We are now moving on to the opinion section of the news, with the first one being our view, get out and vote. A total of 16 men and women have stepped up to run for elected office in Council Bluffs, split amongst the City Council, City Bluff School Board, and Lewis Central School Board's races. We commend them for stepping forward in hopes of working to make the city and area schools better. We thank them for doing so, and we ask that you show a sign of respect for their decision to put their name on the ballot. The City and School Board election will be held today, with polls open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. In the Lewis Central School Board race, candidates competing for 4 seats up for grabs on the Lewis Central School Board are encumbrance: Robert Hendricks, 64, retired engineer and business manager; Travis Houston, 44, poker dealer; Jennifer McDaniel, 44, certified public accountant; and Doreen Scheffner, 60, research resources project coordinator and vice chancellor of research, University of Nebraska Medical Center, as well as challengers Kyle Bruno, 39, project manager for a building automation company; Aaron Peterson, 38, business owner; and Tim Wright, 43, associate director of quality, All Pharmaceutical Manufacturing, LLC. In the Council Bluff School Board race, those vying for the 3 spots on the Council Bluff School Board, including Cynthia Daniels, 52, a registered nurse at Chi Health Mercy Hospital; Robin McDaniel, 55, a contractor for Veterans Health Administration with a background in accounting; Lawyer Myers, 27, a victim advocate; Patrick Peters, 30, a software developer at Gallup and cybersecurity graduate student at UNO; and Jared Tripp, 38, a liability insurance claims professional. And in the Council Bluff City Council race, 4 candidates: healthcare professional Lindsay Danielson, retired firefighter, and electrician Steve Gorman; real estate agent Joe Don Hunter; and Boys and Girls Club director Chris Peterson are vying for 2 spots on the council. In the pages of the Nonpareil at nonpareilonline.com and elsewhere, these candidates have explained their visions for their representative or for the respective office they seek. We encourage you to read those articles and get out today if you haven't already cast a ballot and make your voice heard. While national politics garnered the headlines, local news government is where many of the decisions that affect your lives are made, and local government is where your accessible elected officials reside. These are neighbors and friends, acquaintances and co-workers, people we see at the grocery store, people we see at community events. We encourage everybody to get out there and make your voice heard. The next story, Murphy Column, New Maps, New Political Intrigue. Now that we have new political maps for the next decade, we can start to look ahead at what the next elections in Iowa might look like. But first, we will pause only briefly here to remind the readers that it was suggested in this space 1 week ago that it seemed more likely than not that Iowa Republican state lawmakers would approve of the second set of proposed redistricting maps, which is exactly what they did last week during a special session in the Iowa legislative. Now that a little break back padding session is out of the way, let's talk about the future. While political considerations are not, as stated in Iowa law, to factor when the state's nonpartisan legislative services agencies draw up the maps, the reality is the new boundaries created political impacts. Perhaps the most interesting penning decision will come from the U.S. Representative Marionette Miller Meeks, the Republican in her first term representing the current 2nd District, but her home in Ottumwa was drawn into the new 3rd District if she stays put. And assuming she would survive any potential primary challenge, she could possibly face U.S. Rep. Cindy Axe as Democrat who is serving her 2nd term representing Central Iowa's 3rd District. Of course, Axne has her own decisions to make. She is still considering a potential run for governor. If Miller Meeks runs in the 1st, she could have to face Zach Nunn, from whom she served in Iowa Senate, in a primary race. Nunn had announced his candidacy in the current 3rd District, but his home in Altoona was moved into the new 1st District. It started to feel like you won't be able to tell a candidate without a program next year. The new maps retained a potential battle for the former KCRG-TV anchors in what will be the new 2nd District, Republican Ashley Hilson, who is serving her first term representing the current 1st District, and Democratic Liz Manthus. Both live in the new 2nd District. Quick sidebar, my first question to the fine folks at LSA will be, how were the districts numbered, and didn't you have any leeway to change the numbering method? Because the new district is very similar to the current 2nd district and vice versa, there is no meaningful impact on Iowa elections or politics, but it sure will test my memory and editors' attention over the next year. At the state house level, I'm hearing that Republicans are generally happy with the new maps, and Democrats are accepting them through a clenched teeth smile. In the Iowa Senate, Democrats recognize their path back to a majority still will take multiple election cycles. But they have two big targets painted for next year elections. Jack Whitaker, the Republican majority leader in the Iowa Senate, lives in an Ankeny district that has been getting a little better for Democrats and got a little more so with its change in redistricting. Unseating a legislative leader, no matter how politically competitive the district, is no easy feat. But it is also not unprecedented. Republicans did it in 2016 when they beat former Iowa Senate Majority Leader Mike Gronstal, a Democrat from Council Bluffs. Senate Democrats also have their eye on Robbie Smith, a Republican from Davenport, who has taken the lead on State House Republicans' election bills. If both stay put, Smith could face Jim Lakem, a longtime state legislator and senator from Davenport, in what would be a wildly interesting race. Come what may, pending the governor's signature, we have our maps, the restricting process is over, and Iowa's gold standard was not tampered with, regardless of the electoral outcomes on the next 10 years. That was a victory for all. The next piece on opinion is Fernie Column, November is for giving, giving thanks, and giving back. The Halloween trunks have closed, and the treats are gobbled up. As the calendar flips to November, now is the time to pause before the rush of the holidays and to be intentional about giving, both giving thanks and giving back. Council Bluffs and Southwest Iowa have much to be thankful for this season. Our community endured another year of COVID-19, and hardworking local nonprofits pushed to offer more services and programs than ever, enhancing and enriching the lives of our neighbors and ourselves. We can be thankful for the work and Habitat for Humanity of Council Bluffs, which recycled $248,000 worth of building materials through the Restore in 2020, which helps fund affordable housing. We can be proud of the work these 712 initiate, hosting over 40 farmers markets vendors on Thursday nights with an average of over 600 guests per week. We can be grateful for all care health center removing barriers to health care, offering 500 free rides this year to community members without transportation. Giving Tuesday, a global day of giving, is coming up on November 30th in Pottawatomie County. We will call this day hashtag Giving Tuesday 712. After thanking dishes are washed and cyber shopping carts are purchased, the Council Bluffs Metro will come together to give back to the organizations to whom we give thanks. Each of us can be counted among those who will do what is needed to ensure that the vital organizations continue strengthening our city through 2022 and beyond. On November 30th, for hashtag Giving Tuesday 712, Share Omaha and representing sponsor TS Bank will champion multiple ways you can give to local nonprofits like Micah House and Historic General Dodge House. Whether it is donating money, items, or your time, always giving are incredibly valuable. But after those 2 years of stress, local causes like New Visions Homeless Services especially need the flexibility of cash as they plan for the new year. For the past 2 years, jointly the Omaha/Council Bluffs Metro has doubled its giving on this day. In 2018, prior to an organized effort, our region raised about $500,000 together. In 2019, when Share Omaha launched hashtag Giving Tuesday 402 and Giving Tuesday 712, the Metro raised $1.69 million in 2020. Our area took it even further, collectively giving $3.16 million. When you give a little bit, your neighbors give a little bit, and your friends give a little bit, we can experience the power of taking action together. On Giving Tuesday, we called to uplift and support the importance of work that's being done in our community, said Amy Lithrop, Development Director of Paduano Arts, Culture and Entertainment, PACE. No matter the size of the gift, we are reminded that small actions can make a huge impact on the local causes that matter to us most. For the second year, Pottawatomie County Community Foundation will offer a 20% match in all donations to Iowa-based nonprofit endowments. At the foundation during the month of November in 2020, this bonus giving totaled over $70,000. This added benefit allows you your hashtag GivingTuesday 712 donation to organizations like Pottawatomie Conservation Foundation, Hooves and Paws, Rescue of the Heartland, and Family, Inc. to do even more. Share Omaha website connects givers in an 8-county region to easy ways to volunteer, donate, and provide items year-round and an on-giving Tuesday. The one-stop donation portal at shareomaha.org makes it easy to give to causes that match your passions. Simply search nonprofits, make your selections, choose the amount you'd like to donate, and check out in a single transaction. Payments are facilitated by PayPal, but a PayPal account is not needed as givers can check out as a guest utilizing any major credit or debit card. As we start to plan the dishes for our Thanksgiving meals, may you take a moment to also plan your giving to nonprofits for whom we give thanks. All right, the next story is commentary. Is the Great Resignation a global opportunity or a siren song? Everybody has been talking about the Big Quit movement sweeping across the U.S. and beyond. Experts are grappling with statistics showing record-breaking labor shortages, from Amazon warehouse floors to centers of the care and knowledge economy. For centuries, work has been at the heart of how the vast majority of us measure our worth, as citizens and as human beings. Today, it is the ticket to survival in the 21st century America. For the first time in recent memory, workers are wresting back for some of their powers, as employees struggle to fill vacancies and devise new methods to entice people back to work. Could this be the end of corporate exploitation? Bad bosses? Long and thankless hours at the beginning of something new? A new form of freedom? As a historical sociologist of labor, I believe this is a crucial moment for reflection. What exactly are we running towards? Is the solution to the ills of the modern work to go out on your own? What lessons can history teach us? After slavery was abolished in the 19th century, ex-slaves, migrants, and the working classes were all told to cherish their freedom. But they quickly learned that freedom meant work. Productivity became central to the human endeavor, the gold standard for personal flourishing and social progress. The free labor contract, too, became the law of civilized nations. No longer could individuals be coerced, bound, or whipped into work. The age of consent had arrived. Yet, what did this mean when to survive was to voluntarily sign away all waking hours to the factory, mine, or plantation owner? Some relief was found in the 20th century social contract with the welfare state, due in large part to victories in organized labor, but since the 1980s, the state has rolled back many of these protections, leaving it to private sector to provide. In the name of the free market, benefits and social protections needed to survive in modern America are now more than ever tied to the traditional work relationship. Quietly, corporations have increasingly opted for leaner subcontracting and temporary work arrangements in the name of flexibility. The Great Resignation signals a collective realization that there is a serious problem with work. Many are simply not returning to traditional jobs at all. A record number of women have been forced out of their job market, exposing a glaring rift between the social versus the economic value of care work. For others, mental health now trumps the relentless pursuit of career. Still others have simply reached their limit with employers that prioritize profit and gain over their people. Everyone, from Trevor Noah to Robert Reich, has been offering up explanations as to why people are quitting. But beyond working from home, what does this demand for flexible work really look like? Trends indicate that many are opting for the autonomy or entrepreneurialism, freelance, contract, or gig work. This move is being celebrated as the Great Contingency, a new era of freedom and flexibility. After a grueling 18 months, these flexible work arrangements seem more alluring than ever. In response, the companies are already contemplating part-time contracts and freelancers as a permanent hiring model. We must be cautious about jumping too quickly into this new era of autonomy and self-dependence. Who will be there to catch us when we fall? The economically secure can pump social and financial capital into new startups, fall back on savings, and flit between opportunities. But do we all have this luxury? History shows us that freedom comes with new risks. Study after study has warned us of the decreased earning and growing insecurity of gig work, and the most economically marginalized are barely earning a minimum wage. The Great Resignation could be a golden opportunity, a chance to radically transform the central place of work in our lives. But are we matching headlong off a cliff? Voluntarily opting out of the lifeline provided by the employment relationship, no matter how problematic? If this trend continues, this could be a mass flight into precarity. Many are caught between a rock and a hard place. We must tread carefully, demanding new ways to live economically secure lives, while resisting the urge to blindly follow the siren song of freedom. All right, the next article is Your Views, Reader's Voice Support for City Council's Candidates. Vote for Petersons. Let's talk about the power couple that is turning heads in this 2021 election cycle. In their own rights, these two are influential and successful, which is why it's a great pleasure that I publicly endorse my dear friends, Chris and Aaron Peterson, as they chase their dreams towards public service. I read the campaign highlights, director, coach, and proud dad. I do not think I could come up with any better way to describe such a great man in so few words. If there were to be a book about how you should invest in the youth of this community, I would title it Chris Peterson on How to Truly Be Awesome for Your Hometown. Chris has been nothing short of incredible when ensuring our kids have the opportunities they deserve. You witness it firsthand on the football field, basketball courts, baseball diamonds, or one of the countless teams he coached each year. There is a reason he was selected over his peers to be the director at the Boys and Girls Club. Chris is a man of his word. His handshake means something. And he has the kind of integrity that's seemingly been missing these days in most local politicians. My children open enroll to Lewis Central, so for me, I was pleasantly surprised to hear that Aaron Peterson was going to run for LC School Board. I could not think of a more perfect person for the job. She has that infectious smile that brings rays of positivity to the people around her, a characteristic that has been lacking in most recent school board meetings. Erin has the drive that most mothers could only wish for. She's raising, and Chris, these amazing children, running a successful small business and starting face-to-face with the court of public opinion to guarantee quality education for our kids. She is likely one of the kindest women I know. She's also incredibly sensible. She knows how to cut through the noise and communicate on a level that represents the voices of LC School District. Leadership qualities of this caliber are few and far between, and when elected, I am confident that these two will bring an active voice to their respective governments. Vote to take local government to the next level. Vote for the Petersons. Justin Schultz, Pottawatomie County Board of Supervisors, Council Bluffs. Vote for Damianson. My name is Emily Meister, and I would like to express my support for Lindsay Danielson and her candidacy for Council Bluffs City Council. She is the most compassionate, thoughtful, and dedicated person. I am lucky enough to call her my sister. Lindsay is 1 year older than me, and we grew up fiercely depending on each other. Or rather, I was dependent on her. When Lindsay started her first year of college, I didn't realize how difficult it would be without her at home. But it took only days before I was missing her intensity. This girl, in her first week of college freedom, took the time to comfort me while I cried and made me laugh every night when I called. The next year, when I started college at the University of Iowa, I again found myself lonely and missing my sister. I was struggling making friends and connections in Iowa City. Most weekends, I traveled to Ames to visit her at Iowa State. Her door was open to me whenever and however often I wanted. Whenever I gave notice or not, her friends became my friends and welcomed me into their tightly knit group. I felt like I belonged, and their kindness and accepted and gave me the confidence I needed to make connections at my school. This is the same group of people that Lindsay eventually joined in Council Bluffs. She became their family, and they are hers. She has shown the same loyalty and love to these friends and the entire community over the last 15 years. Lindsay is an epic motivator, able to not only get herself moving, but to inspire and empower others to do the same. Her example and encouragement have been a guiding light to me throughout my life. She is now able to set that example for my children, who look up to her like a superstar. Lindsay will continue to love and care for her community as much as she does her friends and family. I love her dearly. You will too. Emily Meister, Iowa City, in support of Lindsay Damison. With the upcoming Council Bluffs City Council election, I want to write in favor of Lenny Danielson. I have known Lindsay for many years, first as a huge college student, then as a colleague and as a close friend. Although I know her personality and know her in many capacities, of all which have been exemplary, she truly loves this city and calls it her home, even as a transplant from Algona. Being that she chooses to live here as well as run for the positions shows that she is wanting to make the community a better place for us all. I trust Lindsay to take this role very seriously, as well as a representative for the female voices as a councilwoman. It is extremely important that as a female member of this community, that there is a voice to be heard on the council. Having a female presence will truly lead Council Bluffs in the right direction. I think it's important for our city to be both progressive, but to have an educated woman stating her perspectives and views will help us grow in a positive way. Jordan Gilbert, Council Bluffs. Compassionate leadership. My name is Aaron Peterson, and I would like to share a side of my husband, Chris, that I feel is important before the city council elections on November 2nd. When I think of Chris, I think of the word compassion, not just for the love he has for me, but the three adventurous, wonderful, and often silly children, but also for the city of Council Bluffs. A love for his fellow citizen or youth of our community, who wants to make a difference by being a strong voice while effectively leading us in a positive direction. Chris is one of those people who does things without seeking recognition. For example, there was a club kid at the Boys and Girls Club who needed to get his bicycle fixed but didn't have the means. Without pause, Chris took the bicycle to our local bike shop, had it repaired, and returned it to the club member at his own expense. Chris is the guy who makes sure families' coats, shoes, backpacks, and school supplies when they come to hire him for help. Even at Christmas time, he's working with families to ensure they have quality gifts for their children. Chris also has a soft spot for our first responders and our military. He takes great pride in telling people that he has a brother and a brother-in-law who are in law enforcement and actively supports all first responders in the local community. He knows how tough a job they have, and he is eternally grateful. He also has a deep respect for our veterans and service members. His older brother, Kyle, is a Marine who served multiple tours overseas within our extended family. We have several veterans and currently serving members of the armed forces. He is a proud American and recognizes the sacrifice that has been made so that we can be free. He exemplifies leadership. I believe Chris would be an asset to our city council because he is financially responsible, an effective communicator, and a confident decision maker. I always say, true kindness whispers, and over time it grows into a symphony. Each person you help quietly rolls into more and more people until it gets loud. That sound is calling for my loving husband, so please join me in voting for Chris Peterson for Council Bluffs City Council. Aaron Peterson, Council Bluffs. Alright, we will be moving over to sports. The first story being, Minnesota football coach PJ Flick signs new 7-year contract. Deal runs through 2028 season. Minneapolis. Forget any speculation about PJ Fleck leaving the Minnesota Gophers team. Minneapolis. Forget about any speculation about PJ Fleck leaving the Minneapolis Gophers football program for other coaching opportunities anytime soon. The University of Minnesota Athletic Department announced Wednesday that Fleck has agreed to a 7-year contract that will keep him with the program through the 2028 season. financial terms of the contract were not immediately available. The agreement, which lasts 2 years longer than his remaining contract, is pending Board of Regents approval. "This is home," Fleck said in his new release. "Our family loves it here, and we are excited to continue this journey at the University of Minnesota. From day one, we talked about cultural sustainability and how important it is to building a successful football program and life program." Fleck has the Gophers off to a 6-2 record this season, and they sit atop the Big Ten's West Division with a 4-1 record. On Tuesday, the Gophers were number 20th in the first college football playoffs rankings for the season. He is 32-21 overall, Minnesota, including 24-10 in his past 34 games. In 2019, during a season in which the Gophers went 11-2, won the Outback Bowl, and finished number 10th in the final Associated Press Top 25, Fleck signed a 7-year contract extending worth $33.25 million. Under that deal, he was set to make $4.42 million this season, including a pandemic pay reduction that he and the other Gophers coaches are taking. In his fifth season, Fleck is 10th already in school history in games coached, 53, and 6th in wins, 32. Fleck's .603 winning percentage is third best among the 11 Minnesota coaches with at least 45 games at the helm, trailing only Henry L. Williams, .786, 1900-21, and Bernie Burnham's .716, 1932-41, 45-50. PJ and Heather continue to do everything the right way, Carl said in the news release. He continues to build a program that fans can take great pride in, and his student athletes compete at a high level academically, athletically, and socially. He is a tremendous recruiter and has evaluated the stature of our program by an immeasurable amount. I am grateful to President Gable and the Board of Regents for their continued support, and I look forward to Coach Fleck continuing the lead on the Gophers. All right, and then we have a few different path to college football playoff here. I look to the top teams and what lies ahead. Alabama, rank 1, record 5-0-2-0 SEC. Quality wins. Number 14, Miami, 44-13 at number 11. Florida, 31-29 versus number 12th, Ole Miss, 42-21. Toughest remaining games. Number 13, Arkansas, November 20th. At November 18th, Auburn, November 27th. Path to the playoff is very clear. The Crimson Tide has appeared in the playoff 6 of the past 7 seasons, with another trip to the semifinals seeing in a minute. Alabama has 3 quality wins over the top 15 teams and most of anybody in the country. Or in the county. No, in the country. The remaining schedule is about the toughest in the country, and it can couple that with the possibility of playing another SEC champion, and it's easy to see why the Tide are one of the early favorites. Georgia, ranked 2, record 5-0-3-0 SEC. Quality wins versus number 3, Clemson, 10-3 versus number 8, Arkansas, 37-0. Toughest remaining games. At November 18th, Auburn, October 9th versus number 16, Kentucky, October 16th versus number 20th, Florida, October 30th. Path to playoffs clear. Georgia cleared another hurdle on its journey back to the playoffs with a win over Arkansas. The Bulldogs have 2 quality wins over the top 10 teams, but it's a date with Florida on October 30th in Jacksonville that most will likely decide with direction the Kirby Smart team going into the postseason. Beat the Gators and you claim the SEC East and trip to the SEC champions. Either way, a one-loss SEC team has better than average chance of making the top 4. Iowa, ranked 3, record 5-0-2-0 Big Ten. Quality wins versus number 17, Indiana, 34-6. At number 9th, Iowa State, 27-17. Toughest remaining games versus number 4, Penn State, October 9th. Path to the playoff, a little rocky. Iowa has a much easier road to navigate, even with a game against Penn State looming. The Hawkeyes could technically still survive if they lost to the Nittany Lions, and they would need to win the remaining games to claim the Big Ten title to make that happen. Julio Cortez. Penn State, rank 4, record 5-0-2-0 Big Ten. Quality wins at number 12 Wisconsin, 16-10 versus number 22 Auburn, 28-20. Toughest remaining games, number 3 Iowa, October 9th at number 7 Ohio State, October 30th versus number 9 Michigan, November 30th at number 3 Michigan State, November 27th. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 4th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Iris program, please call the toll-free from anywhere within Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Sean from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening.